The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, the main case. Master Linji said to the assembly, "There is a true person of no rank. This person goes in and out of your senses. Those who have not yet had realization, look, look." Dharosha's commentary. The true person of no rank is the real form of truth as it appears throughout the universe. It's fluid and in a constant state of becoming. The true person of rank is the real form of truth as it appears throughout the universe. It too is fluid and in a constant state of becoming. Rank, no rank, are non-dual. Therefore, each and everything, up to and including each one of us, exists thus. The essence of all phenomena is thusness. The real nature of body and mind is thusness. Therefore, it cannot be attained by any personal effort, realized or not. It has always been manifesting as our very life itself. The verse. It is at once you, yet you are not it. It must be understood in this way if you are to merge with suchness. Good morning. A true person of no rank. You know, let's remember that the koans, you know, with all of the teachings, the precepts, the practices that are pointing to the fundamental, which is this true person, the koans are always pointing to the fundamental. Whatever their appearance, however they express themselves, whatever's being brought into the koan is always pointing to the fundamental. Because the Buddha said, that's where we are liberated. True person, a true here is to be free of contrivance, of falseness, of concepts. It can't be defined or limited by words, by history, by our perceptions. True means true to itself, in and of itself, and in relationship to everything. True means in all times and places without impurity or purity. The Buddha understood this before his enlightenment, that his liberation had to arise from something that was not a result of his own actions. So Dharmarishi says it cannot be attained by any personal effort, because he understood that if any liberation that he might experience was a result of his effort, then it was impermanent because it was dependent upon that effort, and therefore it couldn't be fully liberating. And so he, in his enlightenment, talked about the unconditioned, the unborn, the undying, uncreated, unproduced. And so then we all want to know, okay, so then, but what do I produce? What do I create? What do I give birth to? And what Dharmarishi is pointing to here is that we can live in harmony with this true person. That's the path. In our mind, in our awareness, in our body, in our words and thoughts. But most of us don't. And even as practitioners, we don't. Much of the time. That's what practice is about, is directly realizing this true person and then harmonizing, integrating what Dogen spoke of as inner and outer. When we don't, that's what we call our delusion and samsara. We call it our pain and suffering. We call it our attachments and afflictions. I was reading a book, an early sutra by the Buddha on dependent arising, and which was translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of our Buddhist national treasures for having translated so many texts from the early teachings. And in his introduction, the way he talks about the self, I thought was interesting. He said, once the notion I am, so the Buddha said that that's one of the primary ways in which the sense of self arises, just the sense that I am. And he said, once that arises and comes into the focus of our awareness, then it is taken up as a theme for reflection. In other words, we reflect on it. Once the sense that I am comes into my mind, then it seems to be the most interesting thing of all. Right? The biggest show in town. And so I want to look at that and reflect on it. And yet, he says, it is found to contain a lurking ambiguity. For while the idea I is doubtlessly present as a signification of each experience, that sense of I am seems to be present in every experience I have, so it's hugely significant, but it seems to somehow be empty of any content. I can't find it. Ultimately, we realize that's because it is unfindable. It is not a thing. He says, conceptually, then, it only appears in the negative, and yet it is a strange negative, for it proposes to be the essential purport of the entire experiential event, its irreplaceable center and support. In other words, everything seems to depend upon it. In fact, the very notion of letting go of the self, of selflessness, of emptiness of the self, it's like, how is that even possible? How could all of this be happening without the self? It is all happening without the self. Always has been, always will, because there is no essential, self-existing, permanent, autonomous, findable self. He says, as soon as the notion I comes into view as the ubiquitous intention of every cognitive act, it, the self, begins to seek a content, right? There's a demand for form and shape in the domain of concrete fact. In other words, I need to flesh it out so that there is something. And that's, of course, the story of our lives, fleshing that out, creating content, form and shape. He says that's what we call a personality view in Buddhism. And he says, then we begin to speculate. And of course, a lot of this is happening outside of our conscious awareness. You know, it's not like at some point in our early development, it's like, oh my God, I am. But what is that? So let me go fill it in with some content. We don't think like that. But when we think about as a young person, creating a sense of self, I mean, we talk about that. That's what young people do. That's like part of the job is formulating a sense of the individual, which is not a bad thing, but it gets interfused with a lot of ideas. So he says, so then we start to speculate. And one of the ways Buddhism teaches that we speculate is about its future. It's like, okay, well, how does this all end up? And so in Buddhism, it says, Buddhism teaches, it's either eternal, the sense of self is eternal, right? And we can take some comfort in that. Or a nihilistic view, it doesn't exist, that at death it's just over, done. Nothing more to it. And the Buddha rejected both of those as just another duality. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, this activity of conceiving, of speculating, is based on three basic functions. One is craving, our desire. The other is conceit, which is the sense of, we think of it as being conceited, egoistic, which it is in a way, but it's really based in just the sense of I am, and then our views. He says, under the influence of craving, the self comes to expression in thoughts of longing and desire. That's how craving shows up, what we want. Under the influence of conceit, it becomes manifest in judgments and comparisons, whereby we rank ourselves in relation to others, superior, equal, inferior. And under the influence of views, which is a theoretical bent of thought, the ego bias issues in dogmas, tenets, and speculations concerning the reality and nature of the personal self and its locus, the world. So longing and desire, the sense of judgments, comparisons, ranking, and dogmas. Seen any of this going around lately? So I am basically shows up as the center of every experience, the most significant thing, in a sense, right? Which is why being selfless or caring for others is a spiritual virtue. And I think virtually all of the great religions, because it's a going beyond, a transcending or a suspension or somehow not getting overly caught in that sense of I am. And so it can be a moral, have a moral sort of imperative associated with it. It can be just a religious teaching. It's a good thing to do. It's a good way of being. That is true. But in Buddhism, it's based to the actual reality. It's not just a moral principle. In fact, in Buddhism, there is no moral principle that's separate from the reality of things. The whole of the Buddha's teaching, the whole of the Buddha's life was based on his actual direct experience of the way things are. And then the teachings were how to express both that reality and then how to live in accord with it. So what is this self? Where is it? I think, I feel, I taste, I touch, I love, I hate, but where is this self? And so as he says, we seek to fill in the gaps. I want to feel good. I don't want to feel bad, my craving. I am the one who wants, who seeks, who wants to free myself of delusion, who wants to meditate and gain enlightenment. And what does this all mean? What do I believe? How do I see the world? What is true and not true? And what the Buddha realized is that these views, these beliefs, are not just sort of floating around. You know, you pick one up off the shelf because it's attractive. When you don't like it anymore, you put it back and get another one. If it were that easy. But that they're arising from and completely interdependent with our sense of ourself. That's why all of these are connected, so intimately connected. The craving arises out of a sense of I am. I am the one who's craving. The basis of what I crave for is based in my view. What's going to give me what I want? That's why practice is so challenging, right? You know, it's not just a matter of letting go of something that we're holding on to, although that is an essential part of the practice. But it's going to that very deep basis that is within everything. So we're invested. In short, we're invested. We're invested in our craving. We're invested in our sense of self. We're invested in our views, which is why when they're challenged, we don't like that, right? So that's why we sort of tend to impulsively act offensively. Something is being threatened. It's not just that you have offered some helpful criticism. Myself experiences that as a direct threat. And so when we begin to be aware of this, some of us will just double down on the program, double down on the self, crave more, make I larger, make more rigid and dogmatic the views. Don't let anything in that would threaten that. Seeing any of that going around? And of course, throughout our lives, our world, our society, the world presents us with various ways to do all of this and also to, at every step along the way, rank ourselves. Where do we stand? What's our position? How do we line up? Who's in front? Who's behind? I've read that in the, you know, going back a long time, that a village chief, that their primary responsibility was to make sure everybody else was okay. And in times when things were not plentiful, that their job was to make sure everybody had enough and they would go without if need be. But once cultivated agriculture came onto the scene, and people learned to grow and grow surplus so that they could store things for times when times were wanting. That was great, right? A revolution. But then those surpluses had to be stored somewhere, right? Who's got the key? And historians actually sort of recognize, as I understand it, that is the beginning of that differential of power, where the village chief went from being equal and sometimes having less than to being the one with the power. Seen any of that going around? So, are you in or out? And if you're in, where do you stand? Where do you rank? Based on what standard of measurement? We don't lack for various units of measurement in this department. The Buddha said that there, another way of looking at it is that there are eight worldly concerns. Do you have happiness or are you suffering? Are you famous or are you insignificant? Are you being praised or blamed? Are you gaining or losing? That we can live our lives basically in a race. And the Buddha said, whatever those units of measurement, whatever the view, whatever the craving, whatever the sense of I am, they're all impermanent. When we rely on those for any kind of lasting, ongoing, deep, sustained happiness, contentment, fulfillment, he said, you will not succeed. Not because you're not trying, but because it is based on a wrong view. It's based on something that is not true. So that's why in the beginning of Zazen instruction, it's like if we could appreciate how when we're just getting instruction in Zazen, the earth should start quaking, right? The rafters should start splitting, right? That we're actually hearing, receiving a radical revolutionary way of being that is also primordial, the most natural, accessible, kind thing that's happening. We usually don't quite see it all that way yet. But one of the things that's taught is to, when things arise, do not judge them. Try not to judge them. Don't create a rank. This is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, this should be, this shouldn't be. Craving, I am, view, are all being brought forth in that moment of judging. I decide what's right and wrong. I am the one who likes or doesn't like this, and it is based on what I think, what I believe. And all the while, there is a true person of no rank, free of that, not bound, that goes in and out of our senses. And because of that, it appears like there's someone seeing, hearing, thinking, tasting. There is seeing, hearing, thinking, tasting. There's just no I am in all of that. The Buddha said, there is just seeing. There is just hearing. That's the reality. And when we realize that, then we are freed of that centerpiece that we cling to, that we build up, that gets threatened, that is discouraged, that is insecure, that is fearful. Dogen said we should make concentrated effort to understand this in detail. Rather than love the carved dragon, we should go on to love the real dragon. So the dragon in Buddhism is an enlightened being. That's why we have one at the front door. Right. And that dragon flies, she swims, she walks. She has all kinds of ways of being. So Dogen is saying, love the real dragon, not the carved one, not the one that we make up, not the contrived one, but the true person, Love that one rather than the carved one. But then he goes on to say, but we should learn that both the carved and the real dragons have the ability to produce clouds and rain, to bring life to the earth. Dadarishi says, the true person of no rank is the real form of truth. He says, the true person of rank is the real form of truth. A real dragon and a carved dragon. But if the true person of no rank is everyone's nature, is your nature, you brought it here with you. It was your true nature before you ever heard of Buddhism. It's true whether you're thinking about it or not, whether you care or not. But if that's so, then why isn't it obvious to everyone? Why aren't we all living our lives as the real dragon, as a true person? The true person of rank, he says, is also the real form of truth, as it appears throughout the universe. But if that's true, then in this sense of self, then why do we get so caught? If that is also a real form of truth, why do we get so easily seduced by things, entangled? Why? It's not that that's irrelevant. Buddhism looks very, very deeply and profoundly into the causation of things, but we can understand why and still be caught. We can see ourselves turning away from something or grabbing onto something, know from our own experience that that's not helpful, and still turn away and still grab on. And that's why we practice. Because that awareness alone is not enough, right? I can be aware that I am judging and continue to judge. I can be aware that I'm attaching and continue to attach. But even in that, that awareness is a slighter, a smaller, in a sense, a weaker awareness. If I was truly aware, the Dogen goes on to say, don't value what's far away, but don't despise it either. Just be completely familiar with it. So the gate of Zazen, the first gate of training, this is what Dogen has given us instruction in. Don't value what's far away, over there, but don't despise it. Just be completely familiar with it. See it clearly. He said, don't despise what is near at hand, and don't value it either. Become completely familiar with that too. See it as it is. Don't take your eyes lightly, but don't give them way. Don't take what you see lightly. Don't ignore it. Don't deny. Don't avoid. Don't disregard. But don't give it undue weight. Do not give way to the ears and do not take them lightly. Make your eyes and ears clear and sharp. I think this is one of the most beautiful, exquisite, succinct teachings of Zazen there is. Sit and see for yourself. Interrupt that mind stream. Let go of the attachments. Verify. It's an essential part of Buddhist practice. The teachings are offered, and then everyone turns and goes to their seat, and you verify. Is this true? Like, how do I know if attachments? Maybe attachments are great. Maybe these guys have it wrong. So, that's valid. So observe. See for yourself. Dadarishi says, the essence of all phenomena is thusness. What is that? The real nature of body and mind. And that's why he says that in order to understand thusness, we have to realize both the person of no rank and the person of rank. Emptiness and form. This is the great profound teaching and liberation and sort of challenge of Buddhist practice. You know, if Buddhism said, look, you're holding on to this and it's not helping, let go of that and come over here and hold on to this, we'd all be there, right? When we chanted the Heart Sutra, a whole lot of no's. No eye, no ear, no toes, yeah. It's true. No toes. They're there by implication, right? Right. All of those things, every time it's like, okay, I'll let go of this, but and it's like, no. Well, no. No. There's something there. There is a rank. There is a form. There is a body. There are toes. There's smelling. There's hearing. There's thinking. There's being born. There's living. There's dying. Nagarjuna said, yes, there is something there, but what's the nature of it? That's where we get entangled. And so we aspire to realize this true person of no rank without creating an idea of the true person. An idea or an expectation or a hope or a dream. And of course, we do create those ideas. Right? Every once in a while, somebody will come and they'll come in Doksan and they say, I have no expectations of anything. And I was like, come on. Can we be honest here? You know? And that's not a problem, right? I mean, we've been doing it all our lives. Why would we stop when we walk in the front door? But when we encounter those in our practice, can we yield and turn towards what is true? That's the challenge. And you will know because the evidence will come back to you. Not yielding will bring certain consequences. It will be difficult. Dogen says in Bandoa, sit upright, practicing Zen is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi, this true person. And although this inconceivable dharma is abundant in every person, this true person is the real form of truth that appears throughout the universe. It's fluid, constant state of becoming, it's your Buddha nature. He said, although that is true, it is not actualized without practice and it is not experienced without realization. He said, all Buddhas continuously abide in this dharma and leave no traces of consciousness where they are. The traces we leave, right, is what we do. It's like the brick and mortar of samsara. The traces we leave on each other. We cannot contain ourselves. You know, we spill out. I talked about this on Friday night. So I talked about it in terms of influence. We may seem insignificant by in and of ourselves, but we have influence, right? We spill out. Can we do that in the best way possible? Can our persons, the person of rank, when we come together, can we do that in the most harmonious way possible? I've always thought, for a long time I've thought, that a Buddhist Sangha is like an ongoing experiment and testimony to the fact that we can actually live together. We can do this. But we need guidance. We need guidelines. We need a way, right? We need a way what do we aspire to? Like what do we need to be doing and cultivating and strengthening in order to be able to live together? And then what do we do in those moments when we're not doing that very well? How do we take responsibility for that? How do we understand that so we don't keep repeating that? How do we repair that? I had a conversation with Chosen Roshi recently. By the way, we were talking recently at a programming meeting about our 45th anniversary. We're in our 45th year. Yay! Cause for celebration. And we're going to have a celebration in October. And the idea came up, wouldn't it be wonderful if she was able to come? She is Dada Roshi's Dharma sibling. They trained together in Los Angeles. She established the Great Vow Monastery in the Northwest U.S., which is one of the only very few Zen training monasteries in the U.S. She is a dear friend and our elder. I love her deeply, and I speak with her as frequently as I can, because she is my elder. We were talking, and then afterwards, you know, we had this idea of inviting her, so I invited her, and I gave her all kinds of outs, because I thought, she's turning 80, she travels a lot, she's trying to slow down, and I said, look, we would love for you to do this, but I understand if you can't make it. And she wrote right back and said, when do you want me to be there? Good news. She said, and just tell me what to do. And she sent me a little video clip of a rabbi who was talking about how you can be in the world as a thermometer or a thermostat. If you're a thermometer, then you are constantly, your temperature is constantly rising and falling depending on what's going on around you. Right? So you're always subject and at the beck and call of whatever the temperature is in the room. Or you can be a thermostat. You set the temperature. You decide how you want to be in this space, how you want to be in this room. When we don't understand, and Buddhism is a path and teachings and practice to gain understanding about ourself and phenomena, ourself and the world. And the fundamental teaching is that it is in a constant state of mutual arising. We arise together. Everything. Nothing arises by itself. That means we are inextricably bound to each other, to everything, in the sense of dependent, not casually bound, but in a state of profound existential dependence. That's the way the world works. Naturally, if that's the fundamental nature of things, when something is able to not act in accord with that, there are going to be problems. When we don't understand that we are ceaselessly creating our own experience of this world and each other and take it to be true and an objective reality, we don't see that our mind, filled with memories and associations and views and cravings and a sense of self, which, you know, let's just acknowledge that all of that is created unwittingly, for the most part. I mean, we do a lot to create our sense of ourself, but we do that, you know, just a sense of how to be in the world. And again, Buddhism says that's not a problem. It's the belief that that is something permanent, something fixed, that a view, even if it's true, if you attach to it, it becomes dogmatic, and now it's not true anymore. Something that is good has now become something that is harmful. It's not the harm. It in my hands, in my mind, is the source of the harm. And in that state, it makes sense to blame everybody else for my unhappiness, for my fear, for my insecurity. The more I'm estranged from my own humanity, from my emotions, from my pain, from my ability to tolerate discomfort, the harder it will be for me to have empathy for others. If I'm cut off from myself, then I'm going to be cut off from others. Anger and hatred will seem justifiable, necessary. And with our capacity for creating views, we can justify that in a way that may seem logically true and may garner much support and is a deception. And in that, we can choose again and again and again to cause harm, to be miserable, to bring misery on others, and think that is right and justified and necessary. And isn't that what everybody's doing? And so in a sense, when we come into practice, I was talking about somebody with somebody earlier. You know, I've often thought that I think all of us come into practice a little bit numb. You know, it's an available and kind of a short-term, superficial, effective salve in a difficult world, in a life where there's pain. Just numb it down a bit. And when that starts changing, right, when we start opening our hearts and developing the capacity for our hearts to be open and to actually turn towards that pain, in a way it gets a little harder, right? And now we can see, oh, you know, yeah, it was easier when I was numb. Was it, actually? Was that easier? And there's a point at which it's just kind of too late for that anymore. Thank you very much. You've seen too much. You know more. And in a sense, I think that's part of the path, is being able to hold that, bear that, be patient within that. And as we carry that, and as we're practicing, it changes. Our capacity to hold that, our capacity to bear it, not just because we develop an internal, thicker lining, but because it gets lighter. The more we understand it's not fixed, it's not something, it's not necessary, it's not you. Your pain, your fear, your distress, your hopelessness, your insecurity is not you. It brings forth craving. It definitely brings forth a sense of self. And it is definitely based on a view. But it's not you. And that's where practice occurs. When we see that we have the power to both create our unhappiness, and then we watch ourselves doing that. And I think we tend to watch ourselves doing that for quite a while until we start to say, maybe not. No more. I don't need this. Then that impulse to blame or to externalize or to feel justified is just really wasteful energy, a wasteful expenditure of this precious life. It doesn't taste good anymore. You know, that's the challenge, is for a long time, the poison, in a sense, tastes good. So it keeps having an appeal. That's why it's hard not to keep going back. But there's a certain point where it just doesn't taste good anymore. And when we begin to take real responsibility, even things that are difficult are lighter, easier to hold. And it takes time, you know. And we live in a society that doesn't have time for anything except greed, anger, and delusion. And so that's, you know, just a good thing to know. We could put that on the front door. It takes time. But what else are you going to do with your life? So, as Dada Roshi says, realized or not, it has always been manifesting as our very life itself. It is at once you, but you're not it. This world, this person of rank, this pain, this unhappiness, this expectation, it is at once you, but you're not it. To see it in this way, you merge with suchness, with the true person. So, those of you who have joined us for the weekend, thank you for your effort in throwing yourself into it. Many of you I spoke about with had real questions and real concerns, things going on in your life. Buddhism doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't answer your question in terms of, do you turn left or do you turn right? Do you stay in? That's up for each of us, but it gives you an open window into not just you, but everyone. So please, whatever brought you here, keep putting fuel on that fire. Don't let it go out. I'll end with a poem. The brilliant jewel belongs to the dragon of wisdom. Enter the cave, pass through the gate, take your seat. It has been here waiting for you. Come or go as you will never abandon you. Traces of winter snow and ice remain, the morning air still chill, yet all of creation murmurs of a coming spring.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.